Hello and welcome to another edition of the Organic Gardening Podcast. I'm Fiona Taylor, and later on I'll be joined by my colleagues Chris Collins, Dr. Anton Rosenfeld and David Garrett. Well, last month was our wetland special and it's been raining ever since. However, this month we're turning our attention to compost. And if you've never had a go yourself at setting up a compost system at home, large or small, we hope this podcast will inspire you to get started. Apparently, some people are a little squeamish about composting, so we've given over our post bag to myth-busting on all those things that people say puts them off the idea. But first, I'm off to compare notes with Chris on what we've both been up to over the past few weeks. Hello, Chris. How you doing?
I'm really well, Fiona. How about you?
Yeah, really well, thank you. Always good to see you.
And you?
I have to ask, though, you said last month you were going to tie your hands behind your back and you weren't going to give in to the temptation of sowing seeds too early. Did you stick to that?
I pretty much did, although I have got quite a few seeds on the go now. Yeah, I did. I do tend to resist through February if I can.
Yes, okay.
Just because the light levels in where I'm growing them in the flat and stuff can be a problem. But I have got my aubergines, my peppers, my tomatoes and my chilies all in now because those plants like a very long season. If you want to get good crops off them, you need a long season. Yeah. I sow them into individual propagators and they're all, most of them have been pricked out, so they're all in little pots.
Oh, well, you are ahead of me. So I have also sown my tomatoes and my aubergines and my chilies. And what I haven't done is prick them out. So I will get onto that. But I did give in to them during the kind of latter end of February. But actually, it does start a bit more in earnest, doesn't it, in March?
Certainly. Well, I'm poised, really. I mean, I think a lot of my brassicas I'll start to sow not far off. I'll certainly do all my salad crops in the allotment, in the open ground, my drill sowing, my hardy annuals will go in this month.
Yeah.
So I will be pretty busy outdoor sowing, but stuff will be going on indoors as well.
Okay, well, tell me what brassicas you're growing.
Well, I've got a lot of cabbage. I love greyhound. I love some of the varieties I get given here. And so I'll put my cauliflowers in. It's a good month to start cauliflowers.
Okay.
So anything like that, kale, I'll put my kale in as well.
Yeah.
I think they like a colder start. But what I tend to do is because normally brassicas, you might have a separate seed bed because you transplant them.
Yeah.
But I quite like to start mine in cells at home in the propagators. So I like to put them out as small plants, basically. Not everyone likes to prick out. A lot of people like just direct cell sow. And I understand that completely. I do that with my legumes and stuff that doesn't like its roots disturbed. But I quite like to prick out things like tommies and brassicas because I can bury them up quite high as well, up to their cotyledons, so I can get more root off them. But I just think it stimulates the plant as well. I think I always tend to get a small squat little plant by the pricking out process. Mm-hmm. So I tend to sow thick, prick out, then plant out as a small plant. And that tends to work well with my brassicas. Some people have a brassica bed and they sow into that and then move, but I do it the other way.
I'm interested in the notion of a cold start, though. That does make a lot of sense for brassicas. And any flowers you're particularly thinking about at the moment?
Well, certainly hardy annuals. I've got a few things going. You know, I always love hardy annuals. So I've also got a few wildflower mixes, annual wildflower mixes. I'm going to do it at my place of residence. I'm going to do sunflowers with the kids because they really enjoyed it last year. So the good thing about that is I then use the sunflower heads because they were the giant. So I grew a few last year. This year I'm going to do a big wall of them. Then I use the seeds for the bird life on my balcony.
Yes.
I'm not being funny. I put them out and the birds just devour them in no time at all. It's their favourite meal.
Yeah.
And it's something very satisfying. You've come the whole sort of lot. So I'll do that. But on the allotment, again, I'll do the pollinator bands. I'll put my English marigolds in. I'll put my Cadicia, my cornflowers, my Love in a Mist. And they provide all the colour down the edges of my planting. And that's one of my great pleasures. I've got a big long bowl of that. I'll put summer bulbs in as well, my dahlias, my cannas. And it's very tropical looking. So it's not just food, it's very colourful as well.
Bit early to be putting your dahlias and your cannas in March, I assume.
Well, yeah, I mean, you can do it now. It depends if it's really cold and frosty. Really. Dahlia bulbs will go in now, no problem, you know, so because they're out there in the shops now, aren't they? You'll grow. Mm-hmm. So it depends which one you're growing. Cannas I maybe protect a little bit from that, but I've had cannas in the ground that come back every year on the allotment. So I'm quite, it's very rare we get really cold, frozen ground in where I am in London. So I probably get away with it. Someone in Scotland might be tearing their hair out now saying I'd never do that. But I have the advantage of quite mild weather.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I'm just thinking about the pond as well. You're talking about milder weather. My pond is super full because of all the rain we had in February. It looks like it's lovely and healthy and clear. But of course, I'm always worried about when the algae might start.
These spring days are getting a bit brighter. What do you think about maybe treating the pond with barley water or barley straw now?
Well, certainly. I mean, barley straw you could sink now. I know we do that. Emma's doing that here in the garden. Right?
Yes.
And I think if you're using rainwater, that's a really good start. Because the thing is with if you're filling it by hose, is our tap water tends to have a lot of nitrates in it. And that's what algae loves. Nitrated water is a dream for an algae. But I think that as the water warms and the sun comes at you, they might see some issues with algae. If that's the case and you've got liquid barley, you can use that.
Yep.
I'd be frugal with it. It's not cheap. So if you see it, I would maybe counter with it. But you can sink a straw bale in now, and that'll keep it clear for the summer
months. Yeah, yeah. You can get those sort of mini bales, can't you?
Yes, you can. Yeah. They work quite well here. But I think the biggest tip in all of that really is if you can use rainwater, that's the most helpful thing you can do.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I'm really looking forward to seeing the newts and everything starting to come out. I mean, I have disturbed a few newts kind of underneath bricks and things like that. It's when you see one swimming around the pond, then that's the ultimate. I absolutely love that. What are you going to be doing with your soil in March? So do you cover it? Do you apply compost? Do you sort out your green manures? What do you do with your soil?
Well, I've kind of like, my compost is an interesting one because I have a limited amount of it. So I like to be I'm very frugal with my compost. Yeah. I like to target with it, basically. I will use it as I think it's needed. In the beds where I've grown hungry crops like tomatoes and peppers and chilies, courgettes tend to fruit really heavily. I will then probably use a bit of compost on those beds and I rotate them onto another bed, and whatever follows up behind will benefit from the nutrients.
And you're doing that because you think that the soil in those areas might be a bit depleted.
I think they're hungry plants because my yields last year were amazing off those crops, you know.
Yes.
You could say the same about beans, but runner beans and stuff, but I will dig those legumes straight in.
Yeah.
I don't need to add the compost. So I tend to be pretty tight with my compost and use it as a mulch as the year goes on. I have got mustard growing as a green manure. I'll fork that in towards the end of the month. I need to get that in before it starts to set seed, otherwise it gets really pithy. So that's what I'll do as well. I also, right at the beginning of the month, I'll turn and have a look at my compost. I'll get my arms into it and have a look and thoroughly enjoy doing it, I must add.
Yes, I know. Well, we're all a bit obsessed. I mean, there's a real joy, isn't there? If you've got a Dalek compost bin, as I have got a couple of those, and you lift it off, you know, and you can then look at the layers, the cone of layers. I mean, it's just miraculous because you think, gosh, it really is working. Because it's actually a bit of an act of faith, isn't it? And in that sort of scenario, you've got your cone of compost. There's always that kind of slight moment of, I don't want to waste any of it. You know, I mean, I tend to put cardboard down and then it's a bit like building a sandcastle. So I kind of bring it over onto the cardboard and then I sort of sort it out. And then I take away the good stuff and then put the stuff that hasn't quite started to rot down. I'll put that back in and start again. I suppose the fun thing about doing that is that actually in the whole process of taking away the good stuff so you can use it, you're actually turning it.
Yes.
And also you're disturbing it. You're getting in amongst it in the sense that, you know, if there are any unwanted guests in the compost heap, then you're disturbing all that as well, which is important. So, yeah, I suppose it's important to interact with your compost bin, isn't it?
Yeah, I certainly think turning it, if you want it, you know, I hot compost mostly, so I like to turn it and get irrigation on it and get it to speed up.
How many sort of, you know, batches do you think you do in a year?
Well, compost.
Yeah.
Well, I've got two bays and one of those I'll definitely use.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'll definitely use. It's incredible how much it sinks, you know. I'll pile it up quite high and it's amazing how it goes down as it starts to finalise. Yeah, so I mean, I'll get a fairly amount of compost off it, but I have a full size allotment, so it looks a small amount in comparison to the amount of land I've got.
Yeah.
So that's why I'm so frugal with it. Yeah.
Yeah, okay. So, all right. So we've done all that in terms of you've done your green manures. We've got the compost. We're putting that in places where the crops might have depleted some of the nutrients in the soil. What else are we doing on the allotment? Where are we going in terms of sort of direct sowing, perhaps?
Well, that's all starting to happen now. I think that I tend to keep an eye on the grass in the park, because if it gets over 5 degrees, the soil gets over 5 degrees, that will start to grow and it's a bit of an indicator. But I will do a lot of drill sowing at the end of month and into April. So all my salad bar crops will go in. I'd sow them in drills. That's things like, rocket and salad leaves and I love spinach. Load of spinach will go in. Chard will go in. And I'll sow them in drills and then I'll probably whack a bit of fleece over the top of them to sort of get them warm, the air up. And I don't know whether it's not very scientific.
So do you just literally lay it?
I lay it and pin it with tent pegs. And I think that it traps a little bit of warmth. I'll do it on a sort of reasonably warm day. And it traps the warm air underneath. Well, I don't know how scientific it is, but I tend to get a much stronger start from my salad crops if I do that. And then I'll also put all my hardy annuals in right. I'll do that now, actually, beginning of March. So all my Godiches and my cornflower, my loving and mists, and I'll put them in.
You'll be sowing those direct. Yeah,
yeah. They'll all go in drills, all at different angles.
And will you fleece them as well?
I won't, no.
No, I'll let them get on with it.
And then I'll sow them quite thick and I'll thin them out, and they always just give me bands of really nice colour all the way through the allotment.
Oh, yeah, fantastic. It's great to get it all going in the one go, isn't it? I mean, I haven't done it for a while, but this year I'm growing some potatoes. So I think they won't be ready to go in their main crop. I don't think they're going to be ready to go in. Well, you tell me. When.
I suppose there's always a debate about this. I mean, sometimes I put for earlies and second earlies in together.
Yes.
So we're straight away. So you could maybe lay off a little bit, but I'm not sure if it would cause a massive problem if they go in there at this time, because
yeah,
it gets put on the growth, you know what I mean? I don't know if you like to earth up, so I like to earth up.
Well, of course, it all depends how cold it's going to get. You know, if we have another really, really bad cold snap.
Well, potatoes are interesting because they'll burn in cold wind. And I saw it happen last year. I saw it on my fellow allotmenteers, that if you get, but mind you, they recover, but obviously it's not ideal. But if you get a cold easterly wind, then that will burn off the potato foliage. So that checks them a little bit, I think.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. I mean, they are, we do forget that about potatoes. Don't
yeah,
we?
You
they
do. Really they're actually a tender crop. They're, you know,
tender,
and, they're,
yeah.
And also we forget, I mean, I have this discussion all the time, even right into May, you're prone to an easterly wind or a radiation frost. So, you know, if you think that, keep an eye on the weather. If you think you've got like young potato shoots and it's going to get cold, then fleece is the answer, really. You don't try and protect them, yeah.
Yeah, but I love the idea of fleecing your salad crops, you know, as you've sown them, just fleecing those seeds, let them germinate. And then when do you whip that fleece off?
Well, probably in April I will go. When the plants are starting to push it up, I think,
yeah,
they look a bit cramped. And I need to thin probably at that point as well.
Yeah.
And I think because I have quite a lot of pernicious weeds on the allotment, which I have to live with because it was not touched for so many years, I like that they sort of get to them ahead of those, you know, because they don't wake up for a bit longer. So I've got actually come sort of mid-April, I've got quite a lot of decent plants on the go. So I quite like to get ahead of the game.
Yeah, yeah. So something I wanted to try this year was mixing up my planting, my salad crops in particular, and trying to grow some taller crops amongst the lettuces and the leaves, so that you get that, you really are maximising the space. And I was wondering about kind of getting my leeks kind of a bit more snuggled up in between my lettuces and then also on my potatoes, growing lettuces in between. And
I just think we need to
really mix it up. And I don't like bare soil.
I don't. You never see any on my lot.
Yeah.
By July, June, even it's full to the max. So, and you don't always have to drill soil and have it in straight lines. A good way to do that, I think, is I'll do this as well, is I don't just sow in drills, open ground. I will start lettuces and stuff in cells as well. Break out in cells. So you can then have little plants that you can then just place in amongst your other plantings.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's quite nice. So you see gaps, you fill gaps.
Yeah, I was going to say that. Do you keep some in reserve? Yeah.
Yes, I do. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, all right. So salads on the go, potatoes on the go, the long-standing crops, the ones that need a long time, the tomatoes, aubergines, chilies, they're on the go. Anything we've not talked about?
Not really. I was cold fire back on those sort of tenders that I love so much, but it'd be way off before, it'd be 2 months off before I start thinking about runner beans or courgettes or squash. I'll do broad beans now. You can do those now. They like a bit of
peas.
Cold. Peas I've got in now as well. I'm a bit reluctant with peas doing too many of them because it's a lot of effort for a small amount of crop. Mm. I don't know whether my site's not. They need a lot of water when they first go in, and I'm not always around to do that. And I tend to get a lot of root pea, and when I crop them all, I think, well, you know, I've got like a colander full, if I'm lucky.
Yeah.
So I don't do a lot of dedication to pea, just because the yields are quite small. But certainly broad bean, I'll get those in now as well. I like to start filling things up now, basically. Yeah. That's what I'm looking at.
Yeah, 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 yeah. I started off my sweet peas. Have you done that?
Yes, I have. Yes, I do. I love a sweet pea.
Yeah.
And so they're again a hardy annual. I mean, you can sow them direct if you want. I do like to start them in trays in cells, though, and then put them out.
Yeah, well, you can sort of see what you're doing a bit then, can't you?
Yeah,
yeah, yeah, absolutely. All right, so what about your pots, Chris?
Yeah, well,
pots in March.
Hey, they're looking amazing. Well, they're blazing. All my autumn efforts, my bulb efforts, have come to fruition. And so basically I've got masses of colour out on the balcony at the moment. It's a really uplifting sight to behold.
Yeah.
And you know the seasons are changing. They indicate that. I've even got tulips in bulbing up, you know, the flowers are coming. And so the crocuses have sort of petering out, really. I've enjoyed those. I had Galanthus, I had snowdrops earlier. So it is that, all that. This is my time where I reap the benefits of my seasonal planting.
Okay. So your advice on your pots is just to sit and enjoy.
Yes. Go out there, sit out there with a glass of vino. Enjoy it. Hopefully it won't be too cold.
Hopefully it won't be too nippy.
Yeah.
I must admit, I'm very excited about all my... I've got crocuses and daffodils and narcissi and... mine are still at the shooting stage. You're in London. You're going to be a bit further ahead than me. But even those green shoots are just gorgeous.
Yeah, suddenly that starts to fill out.
Yeah.
All my baskets are full as well. And it really starts to move. I will say that my guerrilla gardening verge by the car park's looking pretty amazing already. And all the bulbs that are on the balcony now will be dried off and will be planted into that verge. So there's a massive recycling going on. And it's interesting because all the neighbours really enjoy that.
They
always get comments about how nice it looks.
Yeah.
And it's funny that people drop less litter then, because it's quite a busy area where I am. It has definitely has a knock on, but you beautify an area, I think people respect it more.
I agree with you. And what about lawn? If anybody's got, you know, a patch of grass that they kind of looking at and thinking, golly, there's been a lot of rain and perhaps it's a bit boggy. And, you know, what would you suggest that is the best thing to do with your lawn in March?
Yeah, certainly I would do lawn trimming. If you're on a clay lawn, you know, like a lot of London gardens are, it tends to look pretty miserable now.
Right.
Because grass, as I said many times, it needs drainage. That's the key. That is the absolute key. So I think that if you want to get it looking fresh again and healthy, give it a spike. So if it's a small, say we're looking at like a small back garden lawn, give it a spike with your fork. Okay, get some, open it up with some holes in it. You get a bag of top dress, which is specialised sandy soil, and you'll spread that out over the lawn and maybe use the back of a rake or a besom or a broom just to work it in to those holes.
Yeah.
And that allows drainage to move through it. Oversow with fresh seed. And if you've got a garden that's busy with dogs and pets and kids, you want to do a lolium, a ryegrass, nice tough ryegrass, maybe throw in a bit of clover because the bees love the clover.
Yeah.
So that's quite good as well. And then, I'd probably, before I sown seed, I'd probably scarify, just drag a lawn rake over it and take out the dead thatch. That loosens up the soil and makes it so the seed can grit, germinate, get away.
Yeah.
And of course, don't forget to irrigate. If it's dry and you've sown that seed, get some water on it and make sure it gets away.
Would you put a little bit of your clever fleece over that seed?
Probably not on a lawn. I'd probably save that for my veg. I think
birds don't just come and get all the seeds?
Well, that's a possibility. I would tend to sow quite a lot, nice and thick, and hope that I come out with enough of it. Yeah, I would have pigeon problems if I'm doing it, more than likely. But I think it depends on the size of the lawn, I suppose. Yep. Yeah, I think the fleece is better focused elsewhere because you can buy a tub of lawn seed and for a fairly decent price and just throw it on nice and thick.
Okay. All right. Right. So I'm going to bring us back indoors again now, because this month it's the Food Waste Action Week from the 18th to 24th of March. And of course, food waste and composting go completely hand in hand. As a balcony gardener, do you do much composting?
Yes, all I do. It tends to be more of a summer activity for me, where it's warmer and I have this little sort of compost the size of a pebble bin, basically.
Yeah.
So all my chopped veg, raw chopped veg will go in there. And also we have an endless supply of paper from junk mail or whatever. And so, and also just office notes. So I tend to shred that. I have a shredder. I mix those two together. I keep it nice and damp, and then that breaks down in the summer and I use that as a top dress. Not so much in the winter because it obviously just sits. There's the because of the colder weather, it doesn't break down as quick. So I would literally bag my veg peels and stuff and take it down to the allotment, and cardboard as well. If I didn't do that, I wouldn't have a successful compost operation down there because I just have lots of pernicious weeds.
Yeah.
So I need to add to it, really. So everything from the kitchen gets utilised. If I'm chopping veg, I'll add my little caddy composter there so I can just go straight into. But yeah, I don't see any reason why you want to throw any of it away or put it in the general bin, because it is all usable composting material.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I find, though, that it is all about getting myself a bit organised in the kitchen. You know, it kind of starts in the kitchen, composting, doesn't it? It's like, you know, if you don't have a bin in the kitchen to put your compostable material into, then the temptation is just to kind of scrape it into the main bin. You know, actually, you need to make sure that you've always got on hand some kind of bucket or something so that you can then take the stuff out. But then I think one of the disconnects that sometimes happens is that distance between your kitchen and your compost bin. So, I mean, you're really hardcore. If you're bagging up your scraps and you're taking them down the allotment, that's fantastic. I think sometimes even just kind of, you know, making the effort of walking almost from the door to the compost bin, sometimes on a wet, cold, rainy night or whatever, you just don't do it. And then, you know, then you're not composting. But actually what you're missing out on is the end product of this fantastic, you know, golden resource that we talk about so often here. You know, compost is amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. I think that you need to get it as a mindset, you know, really. I think if you, when you're cooking, you tend to be quite organised, don't you? You have your piles of different food that you're going to chop. There's a process to it, you know. So just imbibe it into that process.
Yes.
Think of it as that process. You know, you peel your carrots, put your peelings into a caddy, you know what I mean? Yeah. Just so you're just using it as part of the process, and then that becomes habitual and you'll do it automatically.
Yeah, exactly. And actually, the more you take your carrot peelings down to the compost bin, the more your interaction with your compost bin, you can see how things are getting on. And also, I tend to put them in a, I've got a sealed wormery, so I put, which is just outside the back door, and it's tucked away in the winter, kind of a little bit, you know, around the corner and in a bit of a warmer corner, because I always worry about those poor old worms in the winter. But that's really easy. I can just take the chopping board straight out there and just straight in. And the worms are, you know, having a lovely time. But yeah, it you know, food waste is a real issue of our time. You know, we talk about it a lot. It's all over the press at the moment. People really are cottoning onto it, aren't they?
Oh, I think in the developed world, it's a terrible thing. I mean, it's huge. A lot and a half of it ends up in landfill. If, you know, that's what's been happening, isn't it? I mean, if you go to a developing country, they'd be absolutely shocked.
Really?
Appalled.
Yeah,
I've worked in these places, and it's just another game. Everything's utilised. So I think it really is our obligation, actually, our moral obligation almost, to make sure we don't waste as much food as we do. And I know that's easy to say because we're so inundated with it. We have supermarkets full of it, etc. But I don't think it's much to ask if people keep an eye on and making sure they use what they purchase or what they grow. I think that, and now, I mean, probably if you've spoke to our grandparents, if you've made something, a Sunday roast, there was some left over, that would have gone into a pie, and that's what I've got into. I've got my recycling of leftovers has become very effective. I make pasties because there's stuff left over from a stew or a hot pot. So there's always ways you can use it.
Yes.
I mean, it's just, again, that frame of mind, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. And if you can make use of something that is considered waste, you know, why wouldn't you?
Yeah, and at the end of the day, you know, you're after that, especially when you're saving your waste for compost. It's black gold. That's what it is. There's no other way to describe it. Yeah. It's black gold.
Yeah.
During March, it's Food Waste Action Week, which raises awareness of just how much food we waste and puts forward practical solutions for reducing and dealing with it. We'll be hearing from our compost guru here at Garden Organic, David Garrett, who is passionate about ensuring we all know that there is a way to compost every type of food waste, not just veg peelings. David gives us a tour of Garden Organic's composting systems, showing us how we can use them in our own growing space.
Well, we've come outside at Wrighton now to our lovely potting shed out here, and I'm here with David Garrett, who has the title Head of Knowledge Transfer at Garden Organic. And what that means is David is out and about in the communities showing people how to compost, and he's got a particular passion for helping people to look after their food waste and their green waste properly. First of all, I'm going to ask you, David, just talk to me a little bit about what drives you. You absolutely love composting, don't you?
Yeah, so it's a way of dealing with something that we've produced. So we're producing that waste at home. Why not go and process it ourselves and produce compost at the end of the process? So it's circular economy in your own property.
Yeah, absolutely. And at the end of this discussion, we will have shown people how to compost every type of food.
We'll do our best. I mean, I really do think that there's an option for most people to be able to compost their waste at home. And we try to demonstrate those in real life examples. We use these bins here at Wrighton. We also demonstrate these compost bins at sites around the UK, linked to the various Master Composter programmes that we deliver.
Let's just explain what our Master Composter programme is.
I've got a very good job.
You have?
I'm incredibly fortunate, really, to get the opportunity to work with so many volunteers around the UK to share positive environmental messages. We are delivering climate action. We're giving people an opportunity to make an impact in their own gardens or growing spaces. And composting, I mean, it's nothing new. It's a natural process that happens on the forest floor all around us. But what we're doing is we're harnessing in the spaces that we look after, and we're taking ownership of the waste that we're producing. We're not relying on someone else to deal with it for us. We work in harmony with green waste collections, with food waste collections, but we're doing as much as we possibly can at home. And so it really is a nice job to have, to be able to talk to people about composting as a really, really quick and simple win.
Yeah. And we are in around about 11 locations around the UK doing these composting programs. Pretty much anyone can do it because there are so many different systems, aren't there? I mean, it's cold today. This time of year is cold. And if you happen to have something called a wormery, then the chances are that you've got it inside a shed or perhaps tucked inside a garage. I've got my own wormery tucked in a warm, very sheltered corner in the garden where there's a tiny little overhang. So it's safely out of the way of the rain and it's pretty frost free. Let's explore the wormery, first of all, David, just because we're standing right by it. And then we'll talk about all the other amazing compost systems. But first of all, what sort of size is it?
So the wormery, I mean, it comes in different sizes. You can have a little coffee table version of a wormery, which is really small and really sort of discreet, really. But it comes in small layers, maybe A3 sort of size, small layers that are tiered. And it's designed to process small amounts of food waste. And that's cooked food waste as well. Worms are partial to a little bit of spaghetti, but mainly your peelings. So carrot peelings, apple core, banana skin could go in there. But it's a closed system, really.
It's three boxes on top of each other with a lid on top. And the worms, it's their world inside it. And they work through the layers, don't they? Can you explain that?
Yeah, absolutely. And my little boy describes it as the dining room on the top floor. So you've got the worms that are there sort of eating the materials that you're putting in there. As they eat it, they leave their worm casts. And so you're moving that layer up. The worms aren't moving between the layers necessarily. Once that layer's full, you then replace that top layer with a new layer and keep refilling that. And then you've got their bedroom. So they've got their bedding layer that they'll stay in. And when it comes to the time to use that compost, they'll be pretty much empty of worms. They'll be in the dining room. That's their favourite place.
So they're always moving up to the top, up to the top floor. And then what's happening is the liquid that is formed is dropping down to a kind of a sink underneath it, doesn't it? That's right. So then there's a tap on the bottom of that.
Yeah, so there's a sump at the bottom and you can drain that liquid off. And that is a fantastic liquid feed, however, very strong. So you need to mix it 10 parts water to one part of the leachate, the liquid that's coming from the wormery.
So if I've gone and got my wormery and I'm all set, where do you get the worms from?
So you have to buy them and they come through the post. Very odd. But yeah, you can buy your worms online and they get sent through the post, or you go to a local fishing tackle shop and buy your worms there. It's okay. The same sort of worms that are used by anglers.
Is it the Bramling worms? Is that right?
Brandling worms. Tiger worms, Dendrobina, all sort of quite active and will eat quite a lot.
And they don't like light, do they?
They don't really like being disturbed.
Yeah.
So you might leave a little bit of cardboard over the top and then the lid as well. But yeah, they like it quite dark in there.
And in terms of looking after them, what would you recommend?
They need to stay relatively warm. So putting them over winter into a shed or a sheltered position, maybe in a greenhouse, but make sure you take it before it warms up again in the spring.
Yes.
Because they can overheat as well. So they might be a little bit needy, but they're not. Treat them as pets and look after them. They do need that bit of protection.
I mean, they breed quite quickly. I mean, I started off with quite a small amount and I seem to have millions of them now. Do you find that if a frost catches them, could it potentially kill the lot? How does that work?
If a frost catches them, it can unfortunately kill the lot. I mean, worms, they self-regulate. So if there's a ready supply of food, if you keep on adding materials in, then they will be multiplying and there will be more worms in there. And you could also take some worms out and move them to a compost bin if you don't feel like you've got that many worms in your compost bin.
So I always wondered if it was a different type of worm in wormeries to the worms you get in the compost bin. But they're the same type of worm, aren't they?
Same type of worm.
Gosh, that's enlightening. Absolutely fascinating. Right, so is there anything you wouldn't put in the wormery?
So I wouldn't tend to put in much meat, fish, very, very small amounts of cooked food waste, but keeping it to the peelings. But also, you wouldn't really want to put your garden waste in the wormery. It's not the best way of dealing with that material. It really is the peelings and apricots, banana skins, that sort of thing that are best suited for a wormery. But they're fantastic. Mm. They are. I really like them. And as a small unit, I mean, it's something you could have on a balcony, like you say, in a flat, in a small space, that means you can still compost, and you don't need the much larger compost bins to do that instead.
They like it wet in there in the top layer. You know, if you're putting in your peelings, they're going to be wet. But I have been advised to also put a little bit of paper in there. So sometimes I wrap my peelings in some newspaper and I just put the parcel in the top. But kind of depending on the conditions at that point, sometimes I wet the parcel just before I put it in because they don't like it too dry either, do they? So it is a question of sort of having that in mind.
Yeah, I mean, when you look into the wormery, it will, especially at the worm cast, they'll sort of glisten. They are quite, if you were to grab a handful and squeeze it, you'd feel water, yes, water running out. But like you say, yeah, you don't want it to dry out too much either. You don't want it to get too wet. So it's finding that balance. Adding small bits of cardboard or shredded paper, that sort of thing, newspaper, would be absolutely fine. And it helps to keep that balance and absorb some of the moisture if there's a bit too much.
Well, I think it's a really easy way of dealing with kitchen scraps straight off. So we have now arrived at the Ryton compost bin, which is probably a bit larger than you would expect in your local, you know, in your own back garden.
We've arrived at the wooden bays. So wooden bays are a great way of composting at home. You can build them yourself. You don't have to spend any money on building wooden bays. You could use three pallets lined up next to each other.
And you wire them together, don't you?
Yeah,
so you
absolutely
don't even need to be that handy. Because I always think, gosh, you know, I'm not very good with a hammer and a saw. But actually, even I could wire together three or four pallets and Bob's your uncle.
Yeah, scrap wood, anything like that. Yes. You can build your own. And I mean, I guess taking it back a step, you don't actually have to have a bin. Traditionally, composting was just heaps. And that's great if you've got the space. Personally, I do use bays in my garden. We haven't got a very big garden. And so it helps to have a space for composting.
Yes, yeah.
It helps to keep the compost process happening and it keeps the dog and the children out.
Yeah, very important. So right here, we've got six compost bays. I know I've got two, which are made out of old pallets. How many have you got at home?
So I've got smaller bins. I've got three square smaller bins. So mine are recycled plastic that I've got. They're called comps, but they work in exactly the same way as these wooden bays.
Okay, so let's explain how it works then. So if you're a compost beginner and you think, all right, okay, well, I've put my compost heap in the corner. What's the plan?
First off, put it somewhere that's accessible. Don't make it difficult for yourself. You don't want to put it at the end of the garden where you've got to walk over the grass. You've got to put wellies on every time you go down there because you won't go. Let's be honest. You've got to make the process as simple as possible. So find somewhere in your garden that's accessible. You can use to put material in and also get material out of that compost bin once it's ready.
We're going to come on to talk about the plastic Dalek in a minute. But if you've got your compost bays, do you need to keep them covered, David?
Not necessarily, no. I mean, the idea of keeping them covered, again, is slightly down to aesthetics.
Yeah.
I mean, like I said, with my plastic bins that I've got, they do have lids on, but I double that up as potting benches as well. So I use that space. The worry was always that the rain would wash all the nutrients away within the compost heap. They won't do that, no.
Okay. I think other people have talked about having, I mean, there's something on the market called a compost duvet, which is supposed to sort of fit snugly in the top of your compost heap. I suppose the idea of that is to try and maintain the warmth.
Yeah, so you might use a lid to maintain warmth in there. The only thing I would say is please don't use carpets. I mean, a natural wall carpet, absolutely fine. But the sort of more modern carpets, they're not great.
Just and full of microplastics,
they will,
aren't they?
And all those microplastics will wash through into the compost.
Yeah. All right, so this is a traditional bay system. As I say, we've got six here, but that's because we're Ryton and we've got teams of people and they turn it so quickly that we have fresh compost every 8 weeks. That's almost industrial, I'd say. I mean, in a kind of back garden context, how fast can you turn around a compost in perhaps a two-bay system? What do you think?
It depends on how much effort and energy you want to put into the process. Mm. By turning a compost bin, you're speeding it up.
Yeah.
I mean, these bays are slightly larger than I'd expect to see in a home domestic setting. So yeah, to give context, these are sort of a metre and a half squared and six of them. So they're quite large bins. Home, you're probably looking at a metre cubed as a whole unit. And it really does depend on how much waste you're generating. You don't need to put a row of three bins in
if you're not going
to generate the waste.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah. And let's talk about what you do put in them then. So bottom of the garden, got the compost bin there. I'm probably going to put some mowings in. I'm probably going to put some kitchen scraps in. What else am I putting in?
So you're really wanting to look at a 50-50 mix of materials. Mm. So those green materials that are your grass clippings, your veg peelings, that sort of thing, they're nitrogen rich, they're wet materials.
Yes.
And then you've got your brown materials, and that could be woody prunings, it could be cardboard, egg boxes. Put them in as they are. Don't tear them up into small pieces. Just put them in as they are.
Oh, really?
Cereal boxes, stand on one end. It's the air pockets are just as valuable as the actual materials themselves.
Ah, okay. No, I was always furiously tearing everything up. So that makes it a lot easier.
It's an aerobic process. Yes, you really need the air in there. Yeah. It does help to speed up the composting process as well.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So that's your wooden bays. Probably most familiar to people are the black plastic Dalek systems. I mean, compared to these larger wooden ones, it looks much, much smaller. You know, is there a danger that you'd fill it up too quickly?
Again, it comes back to how much waste you're generating in your garden. I mean, I would always start with smaller. So start with one Dalek bin you get on. So with the Dalek bin, I always think it's better to treat it as a jelly mold. You've got the hatch at the top, put all your materials in, get that good mix in there. Green materials, brown materials. It's sort of cylindrical in shape and sort of holds everything into the middle.
Yep.
Then when it comes to turning it, you might want to get a fork in there. Also, just as easy to just pick the whole bin up as a jelly mold.
Slide it off.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Shift it next to it and then fork everything back into the top.
Okay. All right. So you've got, I tend to put a little bit of cardboard around the base. And then kind of, you know, I kind of empty it onto that and I sort of sort through it is what I tend to do. And I take the stuff that's ready, just cart that away in buckets or whatever in the wheelbarrow, and then just put the other stuff back in and off you go, start again. I mean, they do all have this little doorway at the bottom, and you can, if you just want a little bit of it, you can just lift that off and then sort of fork out a little bit of it, can't you?
It's not as easy to sort of manage, and you can spend quite a lot of time faffing around.
And it's easy, isn't it? It is easy. I would say that's pretty rat-proof, as far as I'm concerned. That Dalek, what would you say?
I mean, rats can get underneath and get into it. Yeah. It's not got a solid base there, but also you wouldn't expect rats to want to go to it.
No.
So you're thinking back to what you're putting into the compost bin. And we've talked about the wooden bay and the Dalek. These are not bins that are designed for cooked food waste.
Yeah.
You really shouldn't be putting cooked food waste into those bins because they are open. So it's important it sticks to garden waste and uncooked, your veg peelings, that sort of stuff. There's a good mix in there.
Yeah. Okay. So that's how you deal with your Dalek and how you deal with your wooden bays. Okay, but a lot of us are thinking, but I've got other food waste and I really want to deal with that. And, you know, one of the most difficult things, and I'm a meat eater and I make stock from my chicken bones, and then you're left with a carcass. And I never want to throw that into the kitchen bin or the landfill. I want that to rot down. And the way I have solved that is by using something called a hot bin. And so we've got one right here. Hot bins, if you don't know what they look like, they're quite neat and tidy. They're tall and slim and they're square. So they've got quite a neat footprint, you know, quite easy to sort of slot them in, aren't they?
Yep.
By the house or by the shed. And they've got a gauge on top that tell you what the internal temperature is.
Got now, the gadgets.
It's gadgets, isn't it? And it's made from
high density packed polystyrene. So it's quite thick. It's, I mean, I always picture it as like a wheelie bin.
You're just opening it up.
Yeah.
So
like a wheelie bin. They do come in two different sizes. You've got the mini version and the standard version. There is also a larger version. That's slightly different. It's all designed to keep the heat within the bin.
Yeah. It's markedly warmer inside the bin if you put your hand inside.
Oh, it is today
on a cold day.
On a cold day.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it definitely makes a difference. then it's got drainage. It's got a sort of grill at the bottom, so you can let the liquid out. There's a wee sort of tap at the bottom as well.
In terms of properties of using the bin, I mean, as you said, I mean, we opened the lid and it's a large hutch. So there's a large space to actually put materials into the bin.
Yeah.
You've then got the bin itself, and then there's a big door at the bottom that you can then take off and take out the ready materials. Really important with the mix in these bins as well. They come with partly composted bark chip to help maintain that balance. They can get quite wet. So it's important that you keep that balance going, but also you're wanting to get the heat quite high in these bins. It's dealing with cooked food waste, so you need to get the temperatures up. And so the walls help to retain the heat, but also to get it started, you might want to think about adding the hot water bottle to try and get heat into the bin to really get the process going.
Okay. Would you put a chicken carcass in a hot bin?
Yes.
I tend to break mine up a bit before. Yeah. So you can just keep adding and keep adding and keep adding. You know, for the size of bin, you can keep adding for months before you're in danger of filling it up, can't you?
Yeah, absolutely, you can do. I mean, in terms of time it takes to compost, we've talked about the wooden bays and the Dalek bin. We also mentioned a little bit about turning materials from one bin to another. Obviously, you don't actually have to. I mean, you can just let the composting process happen and do its thing. And in which case, we'd expect it to take about 12 to 18 months to fully break down. In a hot bin, we're flipping that little bit. We're putting a lot more energy into the process and we're calling on it really to produce compost in a much shorter time period. And so the hot bin, as with other bins we'll come to as well, is looking to produce compost in as little as 12 weeks. But to achieve that, you really need to manage the process.
And you're right, it does come with a bag of kind of improver, sort of composting improver. And I think that's more than anything, that's about getting it going. And then once you're in the swing of it, then it sort of sustains itself, doesn't it?
Absolutely. Yeah. And what you might find is that when you take your compost out of this, it's not what you might fully expect as compost. So what I would tend to do is take the material out, and then leave it to mature for just that little bit longer before I then use it under my bed.
Yeah, okay. I can see that because it's incredibly intense.
Yes.
Okay, we've got another system to look at now. So we've had a little walk round to come in front of something called a Green Johanna, which is a Scandinavian system. David, can you describe it to us?
Yeah, so, I mean, to look at, I'd say it's a green version of a Dalek. It looks very similar to the Dalek bins. The main difference is that it's a solid unit. It's got a solid base to it. So when you buy it, it comes in various layers that you then screw together. So it's cylindrical in shape and you're screwing all of those layers together. It's a completely enclosed unit. And that means that it's then safe to be dealing with cooked food waste.
Okay. So what would you put in it?
So I would put all of my cooked food waste and garden waste into this bin. I'd make sure I'm chopping garden waste up. So any woody prunings, chop them up quite small, but keeping a balance of greens and browns, as we are with the wooden bays and the Dalek bin. And we've been using these bins and we've been finding that every 3 months or so, we take the top two layers off, unscrew them, and then we dig out ready material. So we're digging out the things that are not ready yet. We put them in one pile and then we dig out the ready compost and that's ready to use. There are two hatches on it, similar to the Dalek style bin, but they're more of a viewing space, I would say.
Yes, so you can see how it's doing.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, it's a big old beast, this. I would say it's bigger than the Dalek. It's certainly a lot bigger than the hot bin. What would you say would be the advantage of this perhaps over the hot bin?
It can deal with more of your garden waste, I'd say.
And what gives it the edge of the Dalek, of course, is because it's a completely closed system here, then you're not going to get unwanted guests, you know, sort of nesting in the compost. So, yeah, I can see that means you can put your cooked waste there and not worry about it. It is an amazing machine, actually. And I know we use it for all sorts of food waste just from the office because it can pretty much deal with anything. Is there anything you wouldn't put in it?
Not really. It's all about quantities, though, really. You wouldn't want to overwhelm the bin. And the same goes with any sort of composting unit, really. Don't overwhelm it with one thing.
Yeah.
The classic example of that is grass.
Yeah.
So if you overwhelm a compost bin with too much grass, then it will turn anaerobic. Mm. Then it will start to smell.
Stink.
Obviously, the composting process is a balance.
Yeah.
You need that balance of materials. So I mean, I'd comfortably put anything in there, but just within moderation.
Now, I'm told that the same company makes something called a green cone.
Yes. So the green cone is not a compost bin, but it's a way of dealing with cooked food waste at home. So the best way to describe it, I mean, it comes with a quite a large laundry basket. I think that you basically dig a big hole in the ground, you put your laundry basket in, and then you put a unit on top of it. And you can then add your cooked food waste to it. You add these effective microbes. So you sprinkle them on, they come with the bin. But basically, you're looking on the soil life to do its job.
Right.
So you'll find that worms are then going into the bottom of the unit, getting materials and then dragging them back out into the soil around it. Basically, you need free draining soil. We don't use one of those bins here at Wrighton because we have quite a high water table, as experienced in the last week
yes,
or so.
Yes, indeed, yeah.
With flooding on site, it's a high water table. And so all you'd find is all that waste then rises, comes to the surface. So you need a really free draining soil. But they're a really effective way of dealing with cooked food waste, but not getting compost at the end of the process.
So when we're thinking about food waste, there are definitely options. There are many, many options that you can take rather than slinging it into your black kitchen bin and then it being shipped off to landfill. You know, that's the worst you can do. There's one other system that I've got in my kitchen, which I really wanted to talk to you about because I am absolutely blown away by it. And that is Bokashi. And Bokashi sort of hit the market, I don't know, 10 years ago, maybe 15 years ago. And it just all seemed completely mad that you could put anything into a bin in your kitchen and then scatter it with this kind of magic bran. And somehow it would break down. It would pickle the food. Yeah. But I don't really know much more than that. Tell me what it is and how it works.
Essentially, it's pre-treating that waste. I mean, the Bokashi comes as two units. You fill one and then once you've filled one, you leave it for a couple of weeks whilst you fill the other one. But that bran has got effective microbes in there that are eating away at this fermentation process. Mm. And so what you've got at the end of the process, you'll open the lid and actually it'll look very similar. It won't look a lot different to what you've put in there. But then you go and scatter it and sort of pour it into a compost heap and it just disintegrates. It just falls apart. Mm. And at that stage, it's not palatable to any other creatures. So
apart from the worms, who are quite happy with it. It's magic, isn't it? It is. I mean, I am guilty of sometimes, you know, leaving the bin for a few more weeks, not getting around to it and all the rest of it. And then it is quite a mucky job, I've got to be honest. And it does need a good old sloosh round afterwards. And it's a bit stinky, but it's actually the right kind of stinky. You kind of get to know that smell is not a problem.
Yeah, I mean, it's airtight.
Yes, it's not stinky in the kitchen.
No.
It's only when you're emptying it into your compost bin and it's all a bit stinky and a bit mucky and you've got to clean it all up. But hey, it's a small price to pay.
I mean, what we're doing though is, so we're pre-treating that food waste. It means that we can then process it at home. Mm. We can deal with it ourselves and we're getting the benefit from the end of the process. We're getting the compost. We're taking our reliance off of the local authority to collect our food waste or collect our waste and then deal with it separately. I mean, great if you've got a food waste collection and most will in the next few years, most will get a food waste collection. But ultimately, the best possible way of dealing with it is at home where you've generated the waste in the first place.
Rather than the usual post bag, we've got a selection of questions and myths we come across most frequently when chatting to people about composting. So I'm joined again here by Chris Collins.
Hi, Fiona.
Anton.
Hi, Fiona.
And David Garrett has joined us also to give us lots of expert tips on composting.
Hi, Fiona.
Right, I'm going to fire these questions at you and we're going to separate the facts from the fiction. First of all, Anton, compost bins are smelly.
So the normal composting process should only give off carbon dioxide and water, which doesn't smell. So if it's starting to smell bad, something has gone wrong. It's turned anaerobic. You've probably got too many green, slimy materials in there, and you need to redress the balance by adding a few more brown materials.
Okay. Another myth. Composting is complicated. David?
Absolutely not. Composting couldn't be simpler. Following on from what Anton's just said, get that 50-50 mix of green materials and brown materials and you're on to a winner.
Fantastic. Okay, so
You need lots of room to compost. This is another thing that people are saying. What do you reckon to that, Chris?
Not at all, Fiona. Scale is no barrier. You can compost on a huge scale. I've done that at Kew Botanic Gardens where the compost bin could be 10 metres long, 10 metres wide, huge composting. Or I do it on my balcony, a little thing the size of a pedal bin. I put my chopped up raw veg and my shredded junk mail in there and I get a bit of compost out of that as well.
Okay. Homemade compost spreads weeds around the garden. What do you say to that, Anton?
I say you need to take a little care over this. So if your compost is not getting hot, then don't put weed seeds or perennial weed roots in there in the first place. We tend to drown them first. If your compost is getting up to hot temperature, then it's okay to put those in.
Okay, a question around food waste. Apparently it's better to send food waste to the council collection. What do you reckon to that, David?
No, so it's great if you've got a food waste collection. Lots of councils do offer food waste collections and more councils will be doing so in the next few years. But the best possible solution is to deal with that waste at home. Of course, you're not going to need transportation. You're not going to need other people to deal with that waste. I always say it's much better if you can take ownership for the waste you're producing and take ownership of that in your own back garden. And what better than do that and get compost at the end of the process too?
Absolutely. Chris, you can't compost citrus.
Well, this just comes up quite a lot, this question. And actually, in a wormery, it wouldn't be good. They won't like the acidity, basically. So don't put it in a wormery, but you can put it on a compost bin. Make sure you chop it up. Don't put tons and tons and tons of it. I don't know how many oranges we eat, but make sure that you don't put too much, but fine on a compost bin.
Okay, you can't compost meat or dairy. David?
Okay, so in a typical home composting bin, I'd say no. You really don't want to be putting meat, fish or dairy into a Dalek-style compost bin or wooden bays because they might attract unwanted visitors to your composting bin. However, that being said, there are bins available that are specifically designed to deal with cooked food waste. So we've talked about the hot bin, the Green Johanna, for example. They are bins that are specifically designed to deal with cooked food waste, including meat, fish and dairy.
Fantastic. Okay. Newspapers, magazines, flyers and so forth shouldn't be put in the compost heap because of toxic inks. Anton?
So we need to break this one down a bit.
Sorry. That's a compost joke. I love it.
So we need to break this one down a bit and look at what a piece of paper or card with some printing on it consists of. So obviously the paper and the card is fine. That can be composted. And then the ink will consist of mainly solvent, which is vegetable base, usually from soybean oil, and that's only on a thin layer on top of the paper or cardboard. The thing that people might be concerned about is the pigments, but they are actually in there in really, really tiny amounts. So perhaps it's a matter of personal choice whether you put things in. Something with a little bit of printing on, I'd be absolutely fine. If it's got absolutely loads of colouring on there, then perhaps just personally, I'd feel a little bit sort of more hesitant about putting that in.
Okay, fair enough. David, this one is a great one. Compostable packaging isn't really compostable.
So I wish I had a very clear and coherent answer to this one, but it's a very, very tricky field. We've been fortunate enough to be involved in lots of research trials over the years, looking at different compostable packaging. The one piece of clear advice I could give is to look at the labels. Does it have an OK home compost label on it? In which case, should be absolutely fine to break down within the 12 to 18 months that you'd expect. Otherwise, it might take that a little bit longer.
OK, good advice. And finally, Chris, I should be adding urine to my compost.
Well, it's fine to do that, but listeners, please don't get arrested. Make sure your neighbours aren't looking out the window at the time. No, you can add it, because I know it's a very, you know, one of those sort of urban sort of or even gardener's myths that you should urine on your compost. If you've got a lot of greens in there, a lot of nitrates in there, you probably don't need to do it. You're going to make it anaerobic because you'll overload it with greens. So make sure there's a nice mix of greens and browns. Again, the message we keep emphasising, yeah, why not pee on it? Or if you want, you could actually dilute it and use it as a liquid feed. I'm told that if you saved up a year's worth, you'd grow enough to grow a tonne and a half of tomatoes. So obviously urine does play a role in our horticultural lives.
Well, I have to say it doesn't feature in my horticulture, but perhaps it should. Anyway, composting, it's not hard. Equal mix of greens and browns. Keep it wet. Make sure it's wet between 40 to 60% and then turn it regularly and you won't go wrong.
Well, I do hope that if there was anything holding you back from composting, that perhaps you might give it a try now. Thanks to Garden Organics' David Garrett, Dr. Anton Rosenfeld and Chris Collins for all their enthusiasm and advice this month. There's loads more composting information on our website at gardenorganic.org.uk/composting. And we talk about it fairly obsessively on our social media channels too, which you'll find by searching at Garden Organic UK. To find out more about Food Waste Action Week, you can visit rap.org.uk. Thanks so much for listening. We'll see you next time. And thanks to Kevin MacLeod for the music.